Instead, I'll just launch right into my sermon, and it's about the book of Habakkuk, or Habakkuk. It can be pronounced either way. They know so little about this fellow. In fact, the only place in the Bible his name appears is in the book itself, and they don't even know what his name means. If it's Akkadian, it means a little plant. If it's Hebrew, it means to embrace, but it's not certain. But what is certain is that there's an interesting structure to this book. It's a short one, just three chapters. And it's a book that once you read it a couple of times and think about it, it takes you from doubt to faith, from questioning God to relying and trusting in God. And that's my purpose today, is to cover this book of Habakkuk and go through the structure of the book, the ideas contained in it, and point out some very interesting things. There's always little gems and nuggets whenever we find these. This is the eighth out of a series of 12 sermons. And it's amazing how it ties in to our lives today. There's always lessons you can draw, because the scriptures are all penned by one great mind working through 30 or 40 different authors over the space of about 2,000 years. But there's a central theme in there that you can detect. And every book has its value to give to us, even the ones we don't turn to that often. Although, there's a particular quote in Habakkuk here that's quoted in the three great foundational books of the New Testament definition of our relationships with God in Romans, Galatians, and Hebrews. And we'll cover that in a little bit of depth when we get there. But Habakkuk was a contemporary of Jeremiah. That's about 600 B.C. plus or minus. The northern kingdom of Israel had already been taken into captivity by the Assyrians, and the Babylonians had not yet conquered Judah. So they were in this late period of the monarchy, just before the Babylonians came in and sacked them and took them captive and killed a whole bunch of people and burned the place down. And that's what he prophesied about in this book, the coming of the Babylonians. During his reign, Josiah was king, ending his reign, and Jehoiakim was starting his reign. And it's about 100 years after Micah and Isaiah and some of the others that we've gone through. So let's start out in Habakkuk 1:1. The oracle that Habakkuk, the prophet, received. So this isn't something that he just dreamed up on his own. This is something that he got from God. And sometimes you can translate that word oracle, but burden, sometimes divine message, sometimes oracle. But this is something from God. And it's organized into five sections. First, there's a complaint, a questioning. Habakkuk asked God some questions with almost a complaining tone. Then the next section, God gives his answer. The next section, he complains a little bit more. He says, well, and then the next section, the fourth section, God gives his answer. And the fifth section is actually a prayer or a psalm. And when we get there, we'll look through and we'll see that chapter 3 of Habakkuk is that psalm or prayer. And it has Selah a couple of times in there, a musical interlude, just like the psalms that King David wrote and Asaph wrote. And it's directed to be played on his musical instruments. And it's got a musical term beginning it. And so that leads us to speculate or wonder, well, perhaps Habakkuk was one of the temple prophets that served in the temple playing on musical instruments, as it's described in 1 Chronicles 25. You know, David set up the musicians and the temple prophets to use music to proclaim God's word. And so there's so little known about him that the people who cooked up the apocryphal books of the Bible, those non-scriptural books that are in Catholic canon, but that the rest of the professing Christianity doesn't hold to, the apocryphal books. One of them is just an amazing book. It's called Bel and the Dragon. I don't know if you've ever read Bell and the Dragon. I've tried to. I've skimmed it. But I prefer, in my reading habits, I prefer nonfiction when possible. And the book Bell and the Dragon has this story about how an angel transported Habakkuk to the lion's den where Daniel was to give him some food. And so when there's a vacuum of information, people just start making stuff up. And it's true about Habakkuk that the writers of the Apocrypha cooked up some fanciful story because there just wasn't that much else to say about him because not much else is known. So let's read the first section, his complaint. It's just three verses, verses 2, 3, and 4. And the theme of this complaint is, why does God allow evil to go unpunished? Habakkuk 1, verse 2. How long, O Lord, must I call for help? How long? Hurry up. I'm calling for help. Won't you listen to me? Aren't I the center of the universe? How long is it going to take you, God, to listen up? He's right on the edge here. How long, O Lord, must I call for help, but you do not listen? Well, how does he know that he's not listening? How many times do we cry out for help, and it seems like God isn't listening? Well, just because he doesn't dance to our tune instantly doesn't mean he's not listening. His eyelids test and weigh the actions and the characters of men and women and children and all who he's dealing with. And just because we don't get an instant parting of the clouds and a thunderclap and a lightning bolt and have our prayers answered doesn't mean that God isn't listening. He wants us to bear long with him. And in the story of the importunate widow, her long suffering and long persistence helped get her the answer eventually. And God wants us to strive in prayer with a respectful but persistent mood. How long must I call for help, but you do not listen? Or cry out to you, violence, but you do not save? Now, the word violence here is referenced to the time in which he lived, in the time of Jehoiakim. Jehoiakim was a cruel king, ambitious, cruel, and corrupt, and the whole society was following his lead. And violence was a way to settle arguments, to wrongly take property, to gain wealth. And so Habakkuk saw this, and he was saying, hey, I'm crying out to you, O God, violence. Pay attention. The society has fallen to pieces. But you do not save. God did not save every victim of violence back then. We do have free choice, and we have to live by the consequences of our choices and our actions. And people can get snared up in an evil time and not be immediately saved by God. Of course, we have the hope of the resurrection. That's ultimately salvation. Verse 3, why do you make me look at injustice? Why do you tolerate wrong? You know, he had a good idea of God being just and against violence and the punisher of sins. And yet here were all these sins that he saw going unpunished. Destruction and violence are before me. There is strife and conflict abounds. Therefore, the law is paralyzed and justice never prevails. Now, why was the law paralyzed? Well, the wealthy landowners controlled the courts through bribery. You know, there's specific instructions in Deuteronomy that you shall not accept a bribe because it turns the person accepting that bribe away from justice. If you'll hold your place here in Habakkuk and turn over to Micah, that's a book that we covered, and Micah prophesied about 100 years earlier. And in Micah 3:11, he drew the connection between violence and bribery and the paralyzing and the paralysis of justice. Micah 3:11. Her leaders judge for a bribe, her priests teach for a price, and her prophets tell fortunes for money. A bribe, a price, money, that corrupted and polluted the system of justice there in Judah. as Micah prophesied and explained 100 years before, and it hadn't changed, it had only gotten worse. He also mentions it in Micah 7:3. Turn over a few pages to there. Micah 7:3. Both hands are skilled in doing evil. The ruler demands gifts. The judge accepts bribes. The powerful dictate what they desire. They all conspire together. The best of them is like a briar. The most upright, worse than a thorn hedge. So the perversion of justice and the paralysis of the law was nothing new to God's people, or his nation that was called out to set the right example and the right way of life. It fell short so miserably. Back to Habakkuk. He writes, "Therefore the law is paralyzed, and justice never prevails. The wicked hem in the righteous, so that justice is perverted." Now, if you would turn over to Psalm 73, there's an interesting parallel between the book of Habakkuk and the 73rd Psalm. It starts out asking the same kind of questions that is the theme of Habakkuk's first question. That is, why does God allow evil to go unpunished? Why doesn't God just leap right in immediately? Psalm 73, verse 1. "Surely God is good to Israel, to those who are pure in heart. But as for me, my feet had almost slipped." This was hundreds of years before Habakkuk, but you can kind of tell that maybe Habakkuk was just starting to slip a little bit. "But as for me," David writes, or actually Asaph writes, "but as for me, my feet had almost slipped. I'd nearly lost my foothold, for I envied the arrogant when I saw the prosperity of the wicked." Hey, they're doing all right. Why am I grubbing along here just close to the earth? Look at those arrogant. Look at those wicked. They're prospering. They have no struggles. Their bodies are healthy and strong. They're free from the burdens common to man. They're not plagued by human ills. Therefore, pride is their necklace. They clothe themselves with violence. From their callous hearts comes iniquity. The evil conceits of their minds know no limits. They scoff and speak with malice. In their arrogance, they threaten oppression. Their mouths lay claim to heaven, and their tongues take possession of the earth. Therefore, their people turn to them and drink up waters in abundance." Everybody throws in with them because they're the wealthy and the powerful. They're wearing the nice clothes, and they're not hungry and bent over with disease. They say, "How can God know? He's not doing anything about it. Does the Most High have knowledge? Well, he must not. If he did, he'd be doing something. Look at what we're getting away with." This is what the wicked are like. Always carefree, they increase in wealth. "Surely in vain have I kept my heart pure. In vain have I washed my hands in innocence. All day long I have been plagued and I've been punished every morning." So this is the first section of the 73rd Psalm that parallels Habakkuk. Why do the wicked go unpunished? And if you'll put your little red ribbon next to this in Psalm 73, we'll come back here twice more. Well, God answers him back in Habakkuk, verses 5 through 11. And the gist of verses 5 through 11 is, oh yes, they will be punished. They're not going to go unpunished. You ask me why I'm bearing long. Well, the time will come when they are punished. Habakkuk 1, verses 5 through 11. Here's God speaking. You know, the first section was Habakkuk speaking. Now this is God speaking. "Look at the nations and watch and be utterly amazed." He wasn't utterly amazed yet, but watch. Pay attention, he said. "Look what's about to come. For I'm going to do something in your days that you would not believe, even if you were told. I'm raising up the Babylonians." Well, let's just stop there for a minute. The Babylonians were not a power yet. The Assyrians were a power. The Babylonians didn't even get their independence from Assyria till 626 BC. Then they finally destroyed the Assyrians in 605, right around the time which Habakkuk was prophesying. They were in the ascendancy, but they were coming up from nothing, and they lasted another 60 years or so. They kind of swooped onto the world scene, did God's bidding to punish, and then were wiped out from there. And so Habakkuk says, I'm raising up the Babylonians. So watch and pay attention to the power of nations, he says. That ruthless and impetuous people who sweep across the whole earth to seize dwelling places not their own. The first blitzkrieg, they would sweep across with tremendous speed and power and then just annihilate anything standing in their way. They're a people, they are a feared and dreaded people. They're a law to themselves, and they promote their own honor. Their horses are swifter than leopards, fiercer than wolves at dusk. Their cavalry gallops headlong. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like a vulture swooping down to devour, and they all come bent on violence. Their hordes advance like a desert wind and gather prisoners like sand. And you can just imagine the mental image of a whirlwind like a tornado just sweeping across this desert flats with a power that can't be stopped, a direction that's unpredictable, and sand just being gathered up into the funnel cloud. And that, by analogy, is the Babylonians being raised up in power to sweep across in a blitzkrieg and gather captives and prisoners like sand. And that was their policy. Those that they didn't kill, they would gather them as prisoners and deport them to someplace else that they controlled to keep them off balance, to keep them uprooted, to keep them docile, and to keep them in line is basically what they did. They deride kings and scoff at rulers. They laugh at all fortified cities. They build earthen ramps and capture them. And we heard a sermonette here recently, or a split sermon about Masada and how the Romans built an earthen ramp to finally capture what seemed like an impregnable fortress. But over time it was done, and the Babylonians did that too. What they couldn't wipe out in their blitzkrieg, if they came to a fortified city, they'd surround it, build an earthen ramp, and capture the city. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on, guilty men whose strength is their own God. So this is God saying, well, Habakkuk, you're complaining that I'm not doing anything, but look, I'm about to do something with a nation that isn't even a mighty power yet. So pay attention. I am going to do it. Yes, evil will be punished. The corrupt society of Judah that you see around you won't get away with it. Now, if you can pull on your little red ribbon and go back to Psalm 73, this too parallels the God's answer that, yes, evil will be punished. Psalm 73, verse 15. Asaph said, if I had said, I will speak thus, that is, if I will speak like the proud whose tongue walks through the earth, I'll be like those corrupt and perverted people who are seemingly getting away with it. If I throw in my lot with them, if I am swayed and seduced by the power and the wealth and the health described in the first 14 verses of Psalm 73, says, if I had said, I'll speak with us, I would have betrayed your children. That is, Asaph would have betrayed God's children by going over to the dark side. When I tried to understand all this, it was oppressive to me. Because like Habakkuk, he looked around and he saw things going wrong and no immediate answer. When I tried to understand all this, it was oppressive to me until I entered the sanctuary of God. Until we get God's perspective on it, we can see trouble and scratch our head, and the extreme people in the extreme areas of thought in this modern society say, well, look, there was a typhoon, or there was a tsunami. There's no God. Look at all that suffering. Look at all the children that died. There can be a God, because look at all the evil. ISIS is just rampaging across the land. If there were a just, omnipotent God, Well, then he'd stop all this. There goes their false reasoning. Well, they're not the first ones, and the modern mind isn't the first one to come up with that false conclusion. Asaph writes here in verse 17, I entered the sanctuary of God. Then I understood their final destiny. Surely you place them on slippery ground. You cast them down to ruin. How suddenly are they destroyed, completely swept away by terrors. As a dream when one awakes, so when you arise, O Lord, you will despise them as fantasies. And that's a key right there. When you arise, God's never early. He's never late. His timing might not always make sense to us. He's telling in Habakkuk for people to watch. When the time was right, he would raise up the Babylonians and he would punish evil, and the nation of Judah wouldn't get away with sin. Just like Asaph wrote, he looked around and couldn't make sense of it until he entered God's sanctuary. But God will arise at the right time. In the larger context of the world, when he sends Jesus Christ back to stop the destruction that would claim every life unless he had intervened, all the way down that's the macro scale, down to the micro scale, in our individual lives, when we cry out and look to him for deliverance, in his good time, he'll give us the answer. We need to move from doubt to faith, like Asaph moved here in Psalm 73, and like Habakkuk moved in the book of Habakkuk. So let's go to the next complaint. He said, why does evil go unpunished? God said, it won't go unpunished. I'm raising up the Babylonians. So here in Habakkuk 1:12, we'll pick up his second complaint. And the gist of this second complaint is, how can a just God, and he, like in his first one, he knew God was just. He's just trying to puzzle out how God thinks. How can a just God use those wicked Babylonians to punish Judah? Yeah, Judah's in bad shape, but we're nothing like those Babylonians. We at least have some semblance of the rule of the law. But those Babylonians, those godless wicked men, they behead people left and right. They take over entire cities at high speed and have no regard for young or old, righteous or unrighteous. They're just a scourge. And that's a pretty nasty tool, oh God, for you to use the Babylonians to punish somebody who's more righteous than they. That's the general gist of it. And so here, we'll read the rest of the chapter. This is Habakkuk's second complaint. O Lord, are you not from everlasting? Well, of course, it's a rhetorical question. He's trying to set up God here. My God, my Holy One, we will not die. Now, how many of you have a Bible that says, you will not die? Everybody's Bible here says, we will not die. This is one of the emendations of the Sopharim. There are 18 spots in the Bible where, and two disputed ones, but at least 18, where the scribal tradition felt like the way the scripture had been originally passed down to them wasn't exactly like it ought to be. And this is one of them. The real Bible says, my God, my Holy One, you will not die. Well, of course, that's evident. I mean, it fits right in here. And another example, it's a fascinating study. Just look it up next time you're studying on the web. The emendations, E-M-E-N-D-A-T-I-O-N-S, emendations of the Sopharim. The changes of the wise ones, the changes of the wise scribes. There's another example in Genesis 18 where it talks about God coming to Abraham just before destroying Sodom and Gomorrah. And most of the Bibles say, and Abraham remained standing there before the Lord, because the other two went on down to Sodom and to destroy it. And the real text says, and the Lord remained standing before Abraham. That just drove those scribes crazy. They couldn't imagine the Lord, the Almighty, remaining standing before a man. That bothered their sensitivities. So they said, Abraham remained standing before the Lord. Now, this wasn't hidden. They took good notes. That's how we know there's 18 of these emendations. And so that is an explanation, or the explanation, for this seemingly out of context. O Lord, back in Habakkuk, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, you will not die. It's reinforcing that God is from everlasting, because everybody knows that we humans will die. O Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment. Okay, I understand. I'll watch. You're bringing up the Babylonians to punish sin. And I know that you have appointed them to execute judgment. O rock, you have ordained them to punish him. Okay, he's taking it at face value. However, your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? How come you're using those wretches, those guilty, wicked Babylonians to swallow up Judah? Because Judah still had pride on the national dialogue level. They felt like, well, we have our troubles, but we're nothing like those other nations. We're more righteous. We at least know who God is, and we may not follow him, but we at least know who he is. I mean, you can see parallels today to that. Why would you let the wicked swallow up those more righteous than yourselves? You've made men like fish in the sea, like sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them up in his dragnet. And so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore, he's talking about the Babylonians. Therefore, he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For by his net, he lives in luxury and enjoys the choicest food. And that's just so human nature to think, well, by my hand and by my strength, I have done all this. And I'm going to worship my tools. This dragnet made me rich. Gathered up a lot of fish. I'll burn incense to it. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? I will stand at my watch, verse 1 of chapter 2. I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. That is, I'll get up there on the wall so I can see what the answer is. I will look to see what he, God, will say to me, and what answer I am to give to this complaint. He's complained. He said, why are you going to punish? He says, okay, I understand in the first go-around, you will punish and you'll use the Babylonians. But why are you going to use the Babylonians? And will they get away with it? Will they keep emptying their net and destroying nation after nation after nation with no end to it? And God gives his answer in chapter 2, the rest of chapter 2, and in the modern vernacular is, well, yeah, I'll use them to punish Judah, but their turn is next. So hang in there. They're not going to get away with it. So Habakkuk 2:2, then the Lord replied, write down the revelation. I'm talking to you here. Let's preserve it. Let's not just have this be a conversation between us two. Write down the revelation. Make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it. Let's spread this news. Let's not just keep it to ourselves. Let's commit it to writing and make it so clear that a herald or a messenger can run with it. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end. Now here's a hint of dual prophecy. Yes, it speaks of the end of Judah, but also the end of Babylon as God's tool to punish Judah back then, but it also speaks about the end times. Babylon then and now. As you know in Revelation, Babylon is a big end time power that God is going to destroy with the brightness of his coming. So the revelation awaits an appointed time. Again, be patient. I'm God, and I know the right time to wipe out Babylon in ancient history for their role for going beyond with ferocity with what I'd intended, and to wipe out Babylon in the end time. It speaks of the end, and it will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it, he's saying to Babylon, to Habakkuk, and by extension to us, though it lingers, wait for it. It certainly will come and will not delay. He's talking here in the next verses about Babylon and how they will be punished. See, he is puffed up. Babylon is puffed up. His desires are not upright. But the righteous will live by his faith. Now, this is an inset chapter. The his is not Babylon. The his is the righteous. The just shall live by faith. And this was one of the phrases that defines our life and our relationship with God. It's mentioned in Romans. It's quoted in Romans. It's quoted in Galatians. It's quoted in Hebrews. And I want to take just a few minutes to go through those, because you could easily read over it. You know, you're reading along Habakkuk, and there's whirling swords and galloping horses, and this is puffed up, and wine, and all kinds of things. And here's this short little phrase that's just three words long in the Hebrew, that it is the first codification of the first mention in these words of the principle that the just shall live by faith. So hold your fingers here, or put your second little red ribbon in Habakkuk, and let's turn over to Romans. Romans 1. Romans 1, verse 16. Paul's writing to the Romans. He wants to visit them. And he says, I'm not ashamed of the gospel, because it is the power of God for the salvation of everyone who believes. First for the Jew, then for the Gentile. For in the gospel, a righteousness from God is revealed. A righteousness that is from faith, is by faith from first to last. That is, just as it is written, the righteous will live by faith. He's quoting Habakkuk right here. He's saying that, you know, later in the book of Romans, he talks about how we're children of Abraham through faith, not by the works of the law, because the works of the law won't save you. But then, of course, faith without works is dead, and it starts this whole delicate fugue, this relationship, this back and forth that some take to one extreme. The rabbinic Judaism takes to extremes of having a religion that's based on works and merit-based and all the points that you can rack up doing the things that you think you ought to be doing. To the other side, the other extreme is, Jesus did it all for us. We just have to have faith. We don't have to do anything. We don't have to keep the Sabbath. Why, that's denying Christ if you keep the Sabbath. You know, I was watching Beyond Today last night on YouTube, and they had a good program by Gary Petty. Is the Sabbath relevant for Christians? And that's one of the arguments that takes the opposite extreme, that, hey, the just shall live by faith. They don't have to do any works. Well, you just got to keep reading. And Paul puts the lie to that, and James puts the lie to that. And the thought that that's all you have to do is living by your faith is wrong. But you do have to have faith, because God is not pleased with those who shrink back. He doesn't want any of us to put our hand to the plow and turn back and weary in well-doing. He quotes it again in Galatians 3:11 and also Hebrews 10. If you turn over to Hebrews 10, let's read this next quote, the just shall live by faith. Hebrews 10, verse 30. For we know him who said, it is mine to avenge, I will repay. Well, that's God, and that's what the book of Habakkuk is all about. And the 73rd Psalm, God is the God of vengeance. We don't take vengeance, we just wait, and though it linger, we be patient for it. And Paul is reaffirming that. He says, for we know him who said, it is mine to avenge, I will repay. And again, the Lord will judge his people. It is a dreadful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. Remember those earlier days after you'd received the light, when you stood your ground in a great contest in the face of suffering. Reminds me of that story that Clarence just told about guys showing up with machine guns. And a third of the church stood their ground. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. and at other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions, not looking at the wicked as in the 73rd Psalm and coveting their possessions, but knowing that through faith we can have the mercy of God poured out upon us and be granted the Holy Spirit, and with Christ living in us, we can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. We have better and lasting possessions than just silver and gold and property and influence and all that stuff that just kind of tugs at us and makes us want to stray from the path. Verse 35. So don't throw away your confidence. It'll be richly rewarded. You need to persevere so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in just a little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one will live by faith. Again, quoting Habakkuk, the just will live by faith. The righteous will live by faith. And if he shrinks back, the Lord will not be pleased with him. But we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who believe and are saved. And that's what we've got to keep strong in us. We've got to keep bright in us the vision of days when war shall cease, when hatred and division give way to love and peace, till dawns a morning glorious, when truth, when peace on earth shall reign. Just like we sing in that song, we've got to hang in there and hang on to that plow that we put our hands to with a grip that just will not give up. And over in the, and this leads right into Hebrews 11, the faith chapter. Let's just read verse 6. And without, is it Hebrews 11, 6, and without faith, it is impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. So the just shall live by faith is a, even though Habakkuk himself was not well known and we know very little about him, what he transmitted to us from God, the just shall live by faith, is a key underpinning and a linchpin of how God expects us to live in relationship with him. As it's quoted here in Romans and Galatians, you can look that up yourself, Galatians 3:11, and Hebrews. Let's get back to Habakkuk, because there's five woes. You know, there's woes in the book of Revelation. Well, there's it follows the pattern of woes here in Habakkuk, where God is telling him that, yeah, I'm going to use Babylon to punish Judah, but their turn is next. So we're back to Habakkuk 2:5. Indeed, wine betrays him, speaking of Babylon here. He's arrogant and never at rest, because he's as greedy as the grave and, like death, is never satisfied. He gathers to himself all of the nations and takes captive all of the peoples. Will not all of them taunt him with ridicule and scorn? Won't the tables be turned once they've been released from their captivity? Won't they taunt him with ridicule and scorn, saying, woe to him. Now, this is the first of the five woes. There's a woe in verses 6, 9, 12, 15, and 19. Woe to him who piles up stolen goods and makes himself wealthy by extortion. How long must this go on? Will not your debtors suddenly arise? Will they not wake up and make you tremble? It's coming, Babylon. You can't get away with this forever. Then you will become their victim. Because you have plundered many nations, the peoples who are left will plunder you. That happened in 539 when they were wiped out. And it'll happen again when Christ returns to put down the end time Babylon. For you have shed man's blood. You have destroyed lands and cities and everyone in them. Here's the second woe. Woe to him who builds his realm by unjust gain. Again, money, the kind of stuff that Satan was guilty of in the heavenly throne room of God. Iniquity was found in him, and he perverted his ways by violence due to his much merchandise and trading. Woe to him who builds his realm by unjust gain to set his nest on high, to escape the clutches of ruin. You have plotted the ruin of many peoples, shaming your own house and forfeiting your life. The stones of the wall will cry out, and the beams of the woodwork will echo it. Here's another woe. Woe to him who builds a city with bloodshed. Getting away from the economic crimes and now to crimes of oppression and bloodshed. And establishes a town by crime. Has not the Lord Almighty determined that the people's labor is only fuel for the fire? That the nations exhaust themselves for nothing? They think they're doing the right thing. They think they're getting away with it. But God sits on his throne in heaven and just laughs at the foibles and the weakness and the short-sightedness and the blindness of people. The nations exhaust themselves for nothing, for the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. That's a direct quote from Isaiah 11. We won't turn there, but it's a statement of Isaiah made 100 years before that Habakkuk is quoting, saying, well, that God is quoting here. This is God's answer about Babylon's destruction. He inspired it 100 years before it. He's quoting it again. They won't get away with it forever. There is coming a time that we can look forward to when the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. Here's another woe, verse 15. Woe to him who gives drink to his neighbors, pouring it from the wineskin till they're drunk so they can gaze upon their naked bodies. It's the modern pornography industry, if nothing else. But it's also a larger analogy of intoxicating other nations with trade and money and commercial relationships, just like Babylon the Great will do in the end, trading in all kinds of merchandise and goods and the bodies and souls of men, so that they can look at the nations that they're subduing and see straight through them and lay bare their economic foundations. You will be filled with shame instead of glory. Now it is your turn. Drink and be exposed. The cup from the Lord's right hand is coming around to you, and disgrace will cover your glory. And you remember the cup of the wrath of God being poured out full strength on the nations and drinking it to their dregs. There's a lot of symbolism that God inspired Habakkuk to write that's paralleled in these end time scriptures in Revelation. The violence you have done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, and your destruction of animals will terrify you, for you have shed man's blood. You've destroyed lands and the cities and everyone in them. Of what value is an idol since man has carved it? Or an image that it teaches lies? That's what the Babylonians worship. For he who makes it trusts in his own creation. He makes idols that cannot speak. Here's the last woe. Woe to him who says to wood, come to life, or to lifeless stone, wake up. Can it give guidance? It is covered with gold and silver. There's no breath in it. But the Lord, on the other hand, the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth be silent before him. That is, God is saying, yeah, those Babylonians may burn incense to their fishnet, and they may destroy, but in the end, their idols are nothing. I'm on my throne, and though it linger, wait, my salvation will punish them just as I punished Judah, and the earth will be full of the knowledge of the glory of the Lord, like the waters cover the seabed. So that ends the first complaint and the first answer from God, the second complaint and the second answer from God, where Habakkuk was showing some doubt, or at least he wanted an honest conversation because he didn't understand. And that was the doubt phase. And now he's brought to faith. And just like us, as we move on through the years and have our prayers to God and our conversations and our questions, and he answers them, we build that deeper relationship that we realize that God is on his throne and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. Though he bear long with us, he will give us the release that we need. And chapter 3 is Habakkuk's resolution, or he came to that conclusion. And it says in chapter 3, verse 1, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet on Shigionoth. That's a musical term. It's an unknown musical term. But it's used in the Psalms a lot, again, hinting that he may have been a temple prophet. Eternal, I have heard of your fame. I stand in awe of your deeds, O Lord. Renew them in our day. In our time, make them known. In wrath, remember mercy. Now he's going to go into a section here where he's recounting the mighty deeds of God in history, when he pulled them out of Egypt and when he went before them and they conquered the promised land. When God conquered the promised land for them. God came from Teman, Habakkuk 3:3. The Holy One from Mount Paran. His glory covered the heavens and his praise filled the earth. That was the first time. It'll happen again in the end. But here's Habakkuk writes this prayer. He remembers his splendor was like the sunrise. Rays flashed from his hand where his power was hidden. Plague went before him. Pestilence followed his steps. It happened to the Egyptians. He stood and shook the earth and looked, and it made the nations tremble. The ancient mountains crumpled and the age-old hills collapsed. His ways are eternal. I saw the tents of Cushan in distress and the tents, the dwellings of Midian in anguish. Were you angry with the rivers, O Lord? Was your wrath against the streams? Did you rage against the sea when you rode with your horses and your victorious chariots? You uncovered your bow. You called for many arrows. Selah, and that is a term of musical interlude. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and trembled and writhed. Torrents of water swept by. The deep roared and lifted its waves on high. Sun and moon stood still in the heavens at the glint of your flying arrows, reminiscent of Joshua's long day, at the lightning of your flashing spear. In wrath you strode through the earth, and in anger you threshed the nations. You came out to deliver your people, to save your anointed one. You crushed the leader of the land of wickedness, and you stripped him from head to foot. Selah. Meditate on this. Think about it. Listen to the music that is being played, and think about what's just been said. That's what Selah means. With his own spear you pierced his head. When his warriors stormed out to scatter us, gloating as though about to devour the wretched who were in hiding, you trampled the sea with your horses, churning the great waves. I heard, and my heart pounded, and my lips quivered at the sound. Decay crept into my bones, and my legs trembled. This was all overwhelming to him. Yet I will wait patiently for the day of calamity to come on the nation invading us. He's seen lots of trouble, but he's going to hang in there and trust God and react in faith. Though the fig tree, and this is a really good expression of faith here, no matter what happens, I'm going to stick with you, O God. Though the fig tree does not bud, and there are no grapes on the vines, though the olive crop fails, and the fields produce no food, though there are no sheep in the pen, and no cattle in the stalls, that is, if we're all going to starve to death, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will be joyful in God my Savior. The Sovereign Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer and enables me to go on the heights, for the director of music on my stringed instruments. No matter how bad it gets, he took his initial complaints and lack of understanding, listened to God's answers, and ends with this prayer, with this psalm of faith. And if you'll turn one last time to Psalm 73, we'll see how that parallels the conclusion of Psalm 73. Psalm 73, 21. When my heart was grieved and my spirit embittered, I was senseless and ignorant. I was a brute beast before you. Yet I am always with you. You hold me by my right hand. You guide me with your counsel, and afterward you will take me into glory. Asaph, too, learned that God is faithful and just like we can take hope and encouragement from this scriptures, that no matter what our present trials, in the long run, if it comes to it, God will heal us through the resurrection. And our light and momentary troubles from this life, this veil of tears, will be removed from us as far as east from west. It will be forgotten. At God's right hand are pleasures forevermore. Whom have I in heaven but you? He says in verse 25. And earth has nothing I desire besides you, those worldly riches. I don't care for those. My flesh and my heart may fail, but God is the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Those who are far from you will perish. You destroy all those who are unfaithful to you. Remember, the just shall live by faith. But as for me, it is good to be near God. I have made the sovereign Lord my refuge. And not only that, not only will I realize it in my own life, I will tell of all your deeds. I will share that and spread that around. His journey from doubt to faith parallels that of Psalm 73. Thus ends Psalm 73. Thus ends the Oracle of Habakkuk. It takes a converted mind to trust in God, though everything around you looks like it's falling to pieces. But though He bear along with us, if we persevere and trust in God and make that journey from doubt to faith, we will be rewarded.